Chapter 18. Remarks, but, believe me, I do thank you with the utmost fervor, of which my soul is capable. Speech. New York, April 20, 1868. Mr. Dickens' last reading in the United States was given at the Steinway Hall on the above date. The task finished, he was about to retire, but a tremendous burst of applause stopped him. He came forward and spoke thus. Ladies and gentlemen, the shadow of one word has impended over me this evening, and the time has come at length when the shadow must fall. It is but a very short one, but the weight of such things is not measured by their length, and too much shorter words express the round of our human existence. When I was reading David Copperfield a few evenings since, I felt there was more than usual significance in the words of Peggotty, "My future life lies over the sea." And when I closed this book just now, I felt most keenly that I was shortly to establish such an alibi as would have satisfied even the elder Mr. Weller. The relations which have been set up between us, while they have involved for me something more than mere devotion to a task, have been by you sustained with the readiest sympathy and the kindest acknowledgement. Those relations must now be broken forever. Be assured, however, that you will not pass from my mind. I shall often realize you as I see you now, equally by my winter fire and in the green English summer weather. I shall never recall you as a mere public audience, but rather as a host of personal friends, and ever with the greatest gratitude, tenderness, and consideration. Ladies and gentlemen, I beg to bid you farewell. God bless you, and God bless the land in which I leave you. Speech. Liverpool, April 10, 1869. The following speech was delivered by Mr. Dickens at a banquet held in his honor at St. George's Hall, Liverpool, after his health had been proposed by Lord Dufferin. Mr. Mayor, ladies, and gentlemen, although I have been so well accustomed of late to the sound of my own voice in this neighborhood, as to hear it with perfect composure, the occasion is, believe me, very, very different in respect of those overwhelming voices of yours. As Professor Wilson once confided to me in Edinburgh, that I had not the least idea, from hearing him in public, what a magnificent speaker he found himself to be when he was quite alone, so you can form no conception, from the specimen before you, of the eloquence with which I shall thank you again and again in some of the innermost moments of my future life. Often and often, then, God willing, my memory will recall this brilliant scene, and will re-illuminate this banquet hall. I, faithful to this place in its present aspect, will observe it exactly as it stands, not one man's seat empty, not one woman's fair face absent, while life and memory abide by me. Mr. Mayor, Lord Dufferin in his speech, so affecting to me, so eloquently uttered, and so rapturously received, made a graceful and gracious allusion to the immediate occasion of my present visit to your noble city. It is no homage to Liverpool, based upon a moment's untrustworthy enthusiasm, but it is the solid fact built upon the rock of experience, that when I first made up my mind, after considerable deliberation, systematically to meet my readers in large numbers, face to face, and to try to express myself to them through the breath of life, Liverpool stood foremost among the great places out of London to which I looked with eager confidence and pleasure. And why was this? Not merely because of the reputation of its citizens for generous estimation of the arts, not merely because I had unworthily filled the chair of its great self-educational institution long ago, not merely because the place had been a home to me since the well-remembered day when its blessed roofs and steeples dipped into the Mersey behind me on the occasion of my first sailing away to see my generous friends across the Atlantic 27 years ago. Not for one of those considerations, but because it had been my happiness to have a public opportunity of testing the spirit of its people. I had asked Liverpool for help towards the worthy preservation of Shakespeare's house. On another occasion I had ventured to address Liverpool in the names of Leigh Hunt and Sheridan Knowles. On still another occasion I had addressed it in the cause of the brotherhood and sisterhood of letters and the kindred arts, and on each and all the response had been unsurpassably spontaneous, open-handed, and munificent. Mr. Mayor, and ladies and gentlemen, if I may venture to take a small illustration of my present position from my own peculiar craft, I would say that there is this objection in writing fiction to giving a story an autobiographical form, that through whatever dangers the narrator may pass, it is clear unfortunately to the reader beforehand that he must have come through them somehow else he could not have lived to tell the tale. Now, in speaking fact, when the fact is associated with such honors as those with which you have enriched me, there is this singular difficulty in the way of returning thanks, that the speaker must infallibly come back to himself through whatever oratorical disasters he may languish on the road. Let me, then, take the plainer and simpler middle course of dividing my subject equally between myself and you. Let me assure you that, whatever you have accepted with pleasure, either by word of pen, or by word of mouth, from me, you have greatly improved in the acceptance. As the gold is said to be doubly and trebly refined which has seven times passed the furnace, so a fancy may be said to become more and more refined each time it passes through the human heart. You have, and you know you have, brought to the consideration of me that quality in yourselves without which I should, but have beaten the air. Your earnestness has stimulated mine, your laughter has made me laugh, and your tears have overflowed my eyes. All that I can claim for myself in establishing the relations which exist between us is constant fidelity to hard work. My literary fellows about me, of whom I am so proud to see so many, know very well how true it is in all art, that what seems the easiest done, is oftentimes the most difficult to do, and that the smallest truth may come of the greatest pains much, as it occurred to me at Manchester the other day, as the sensitive touch of Mr. Whitworth's measuring machine comes at last, of heaven and Manchester and its mayor only know how much hammering my companions in arms know thoroughly well, and I think it only right the public should know too, that in our careful toil and trouble, and in our steady striving for excellence not in any little gifts, misused by fits and starts lies our highest duty at once to our calling, to one another, to ourselves, and to you. Ladies and gentlemen, before sitting down I find that I have to clear myself of two very unexpected accusations. The first is a most singular charge preferred against me by my old friend Lord Houghton, that I have been somewhat unconscious of the merits of the House of Lords. Now, ladies and gentlemen, seeing that I have had some few not altogether obscure or unknown personal friends in that assembly, seeing that I had some little association with and knowledge of a certain obscure peer lately known in England by the name of Lord Brougham, seeing that I regard with some admiration and affection another obscure peer wholly unknown in literary circles, called Lord Lytton, seeing also that I have had for some years some slight admiration of the extraordinary judicial properties and amazingly acute mind of a certain Lord Chief Justice popularly known by the name of Cockburn, and also seeing that there is no man in England whom I respect more in his public capacity, whom I love more in his private capacity, or from whom I have received more remarkable proofs of his honor and love of literature than another obscure nobleman called Lord Russell. Taking these circumstances into consideration, I was rather amazed by my noble friend's accusation. When I asked him, on his sitting down, what amazing devil possessed him to make this charge, he replied that he had never forgotten the days of Lord Verisopht. Then, ladies and gentlemen, I understood it all. Because it is a remarkable fact that in the days when that depreciative and profoundly unnatural character was invented, there was no Lord Houghton in the House of Lords. And there was in the House of Commons a rather indifferent member called Richard Monckton Milnes. Ladies and gentlemen, to conclude, for the present, I close with the other charge of my noble friend, and here I am more serious, and I may be allowed perhaps to express my seriousness in half a dozen plain words. When I first took literature as my profession in England, I calmly resolved within myself that, whether I succeeded, or whether I failed, literature should be my sole profession. It appeared to me at that time that it was not so well understood in England as it was in other countries, that literature was a dignified profession, by which any man might stand or fall. I made a compact with myself that in my person literature should stand, and by itself, of itself, and for itself, and there is no consideration on earth which would induce me to break that bargain. Ladies and gentlemen, finally allow me to thank you for your great kindness, and for the touching earnestness with which you have drunk my health. I should have thanked you with all my heart, if it had not so unfortunately happened that, for many sufficient reasons, I lost my heart at between 6:30 and 7:30 tonight. Speech. The Oxford and Harvard Boat Race. Sydenham, August 30, 1869. The International University Boat Race having taken place on August 27, the London Rowing Club invited the crews to a dinner at the Crystal Palace on the following Monday. The dinner was followed by a grand display of pyrotechnics. Mr. Dickens, in proposing the health of the crews, made the following speech.
Gentlemen, flushed with fireworks, I can warrant myself to you, as about to imitate those gorgeous illusions, by making a brief spurt, and then dying out. And, first of all, as an invited visitor of the London Rowing Club on this most interesting occasion, I will beg, in the name of the other invited visitors present always excepting the distinguished guests who are the cause of our meeting, to thank the President for the modesty and the courtesy with which he has deputed to one of us the most agreeable part of his evening's duty. It is the more graceful in him to do this, because he can hardly fail to see that he might very easily do it himself, as this is a case of all others in which it is according to good taste and the very principles of things that the great social vice, speech-making, should hide its diminished head before the great social virtue action. However, there is an ancient story of a lady who threw her glove into an arena full of wild beasts, to tempt her attendant lover to climb down and reclaim it. The lover, rightly inferring from the action the worth of the lady, risked his life for the glove, and then threw it rightly in her face as a token of his eternal adieu.
16. I take up the President's glove, on the contrary, as a proof of his much higher worth, and of my real interest in the cause in which it was thrown down, and I now profess my readiness to do even injustice to the duty which he has assigned me.
Gentlemen, a very remarkable and affecting volume was published in the United States within a short time before my last visit to that hospitable land, containing 95 biographies of young men, for the most part well born and well nurtured, and trained in various peaceful pursuits of life, who, when the flag of their country waved them from those quiet paths in which they were seeking distinction of various kinds, took arms in the dread civil war which elicited so much bravery on both sides, and died in the defense of their country. These great spirits displayed extraordinary aptitude in the acquisition, even in the invention, of military tactics, in the combining and commanding of great masses of men, in surprising readiness of self-resource for the general good, in humanely treating the sick and the wounded, and in winning to themselves a very rare amount of personal confidence and trust. They had all risen to be distinguished soldiers. They had all done deeds of great heroism. They had all combined with their valor and self-devotion a serene cheerfulness, a quiet modesty, and a truly Christian spirit, and they had all been educated in one school, Harvard University. Gentlemen, nothing was more remarkable in these fine descendants of our forefathers than the invincible determination with which they fought against odds, and the indomitable spirit with which they resisted defeat. I ask you, who will say after last Friday, that Harvard University is less true to herself in peace than she was in war? I ask you, who who will not recognize in her boat's crew 11 of her soldiers, and who does not feel that she has now a greater right than ever to be proud of her sons, and take these sons to her breast when they return with resounding acclamations. It is related of the Duke of Wellington that he once told a lady who foolishly protested that she would like to see a great victory, that there was only one thing worse than a great victory, and that was a great defeat. But, gentlemen, there is another sense in which to use the term a great defeat. Such is the defeat of a handful of daring fellows who make a preliminary dash of 3,000 or 4,000 stormy miles to meet great conquerors on their own domain, who do not want the stimulus of friends and home, but who sufficiently hear and feel their own dear land in the shouts and cheers of another, and who strive to the last with a desperate tenacity that makes the beating of them a new feather in the proudest cap. Gentlemen, you agree with me that such a defeat is a great, noble part of a manly, wholesome action, and I say that it is in the essence and lifeblood of such a defeat to become at last sure victory. Now, gentlemen, you know perfectly well the toast I am going to propose, and you know equally well that in thus glancing first towards our friends of the white stripes, I merely anticipate and respond to the instinctive courtesy of Oxford towards our brothers from a distance, a courtesy extending, I hope, and I do not doubt, to any imaginable limits, except allowing them to take the first place in last Friday's match, if they could by any human and honorable means be kept in the second. I will not avail myself of the opportunity provided for me by the absence of the greater part of the Oxford crew, indeed, of all but one, and that, its most modest and devoted member. I will not avail myself of the golden opportunity considerately provided for me to say a great deal in honor of the Oxford crew. I know that the gentleman who attends here attends under unusual anxieties and difficulties, and that if he were less in earnest, his filial affection could not possibly allow him to be here. It is therefore enough for me, gentlemen, and enough for you, that I should say here and now that we all unite with one accord in regarding the Oxford crew as the pride and flower of England, and that we should consider it very weak indeed to set anything short of England's very best in opposition to her competition with America. Though it certainly must be confessed, I am bound in common justice and honor to admit it, it must be confessed in disparagement of the Oxford men, as I heard a discontented gentleman remark last Friday night, about 10 o'clock, when he was baiting a very small horse in the Strand. He was one of 11 with pipes in a chaise cart. I say it must be admitted in disparagement of the Oxford men, on the authority of this gentleman, that they have won so often that they could afford to lose a little now, and that they ought to do it, but they won't. Gentlemen, in drinking to both crews, and in offering the poor testimony of our thanks in acknowledgement of the gallant spectacle which they presented to countless thousands last Friday, I am sure I express not only your feeling, and my feeling, and the feeling of the blue, but also the feeling of the whole people of England, when I cordially give them welcome to our English waters and English ground, and also bid them Godspeed in their voyage home. As the greater includes the less, and the sea holds the river, so I think it is no very bold augury to predict that in the friendly contests yet to come, and to take place, I hope, on both sides of the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.